Actor-turned-director David Henry joins me to talk exclusively about his new family flick, Monster Summer, and he'll be joined by one of its stars. Bishop Athanasius Schneider of Kazakhstan weighs in on the upcoming Synod on Synodality, the new consultors appointed by the Vatican's Doctrinal Office, and his timely new book, Flee from Heresy. And the bipartisan report on the security lapses of U.S. Secret Service in the wake of two presidential assassination attempts is making waves in D.C. And why is Democrat candidate for President Kamala Harris skipping the traditional Al Smith charity dinner in New York? Commentator and senior political editor at The Blaze, Chris Bedford, is here with analysis. The World Over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. What a show we have for you. If you'd like to comment on it, you can write me at X. I'm at Raymond Arroyo. Or you can find me on Instagram at Real Raymond Arroyo. Real Raymond Arroyo. Lots to cover tonight. But first, some news. The Diocese of San Diego, led by Cardinal Robert McElroy, is banning Catholic homeschooling groups from meeting on parish properties in the diocese. The new policy, dated September 1st but released this week, says, quote, the use of parish facilities by charter schools, homeschool programs, or private school programs is prohibited, both because such usage can undermine the stability of nearby Catholic schools and lead people to think that the church is approving and advancing particular alternative schools and programs. The new edict comes as the growth of homeschooling in California has jumped by 78% since 2017. Oddly, however, the new policy allows for the rental of parish or school buildings to non-Catholic groups on a, quote, case-by-case basis. The diocese has not yet issued a clarification, and San Diego homeschool groups are awaiting Cardinal McElroy's response before speaking officially to the press. We will continue to monitor this important story. Well, you know my next guest from his big TV hits like How I Met Your Mother or The Wizards of Waverly Place, but now he's returning to directing, this time a new feature. I sat down with him recently in Los Angeles to talk about his new family film, Monster Summer, out in theaters October 4th. And believe me, this conversation is full of surprises, including a special guest. Here's my exclusive interview with David Henry. David, where did the inspiration for this Monster Summer movie come from? I see a lot of shades of films that I grew up watching with my kids.
Yes, and I'm glad you said that, because for me, I grew up watching a lot of movies with my dad, and it was very meaningful time we spent together, some of our most meaningful time, some of my best memories. And I felt like content back then, it was worry-free. There were no awkward car rides home, and it was some of the most meaningful time I spent with my father. Cut to today, I'm like, where are those movies? I'm a parent now, and there's not a lot that I can watch with my children. I feel like I have to be kind of a forensic investigator, checking everything they watch, because there's stuff in there that I would be uncomfortable with them watching. So I was like, why don't we just have a event movie that children can watch with their parents, where both of them get something from it? And that was the key when I was a kid. There was tons of great movies. Spielberg put out a lot, Richard Donner, that a parent could watch it and find something meaningful, and a kid could watch it and find something meaningful. If you think of The Goonies or E.T. or Jurassic Park or Monster Squad or you name it, there were all these movies, and that doesn't exist now. So I really wanted to recapture that father-son or mother-daughter relationship in an event movie this Halloween.
Where did this idea come from? I mean, at the heart of this movie really is, does evil exist?
That, to me, is what I really gravitated towards. Because as a director, you have to feel like you're fighting for something. It's such a hard job. Yeah. You are so in it. There's a million questions being thrown at you at every moment. There's a million people coming at you. There's hundreds of people you're in charge of. It's a lot. So I have to be super motivated to want to make sure that I believe in this. And to me, it's the themes in the world of philosophy that motivates me. And in this movie in particular, I really gravitated towards that. And this idea that evil wins when good men do nothing. And this idea that does evil exist or not? And these forces are all at play in this film under the surface, and I just love seeing them butt heads.
Let's get that gang back together again.
Old man Carruthers' property?
I've heard stories about him. Some people think he was a spy, bank robber.
I bet their bodies are buried somewhere on this property.
That's one in.
Are you there?
What is that?
Teenager is recovering today after nearly drowning.
Hey, Ben. Something happened to Ben that I can't explain. It's like he's a zombie at Night of the Living Dead.
You okay, bud?
Oh, my.
What are you, nuts?
Hey, guys, it's okay. I invited him.
Easy, fella.
This is Gene. He's a detective.
Retired. Well, there's more of you. I'm gonna have to dig a mass grave now.
What? Something is out there. If we sit around and do nothing, kids are gonna get hurt, including us.
It came after me, man.
What came after you?
There's definitely something weird going on here. Monsters.
Yeah. You guys ready?
Not us. Who?
Let's do this.
Kids have this vacant look in their eyes. Lights are on, nobody's home. You are overreacting. It's just kids being kids.
No! Give me a rundown of the film. So, at its core, it's a movie about a group of kids teaming up with a detective to hunt this mysterious foe, this monster, that has moved onto their island and has started targeting children. So if you think the tone of Goonies or E.T. or Monster Squad, it's that kind of world, or even something more modern like Stranger Things. It's that tone, it's that world, just a whole new adventure with a wonderful cast. We have Mel Gibson, who's playing the detective, and we have Mason Thames, whose career is now absolutely skyrocketing. Yeah. It was wonderful to work with such a young up-and-coming star, future young Oscar winner. And we had a Lorraine Bracco, Kevin James. There's a wonderful cast in this film.
I'm telling you, something happened to Ben that I can't explain. You know, he came home, but he's not the same. It's like he's a zombie at Night of the Living Dead.
That's it, Noah. I know you need some big hotshot article for the paper you're writing, but this is getting out of hand.
This isn't about some article for the paper. This is about what happened to Ben.
Just because some girl you have the hots for tells you something doesn't make it true. Look, I know things have been tough since you lost your dad.
What's he got to do with this?
It seems like ever since he's been gone, you've been searching for evil around every corner of this island when there just ain't none to be found.
If you don't want to believe me, then don't believe me. But something is still out there. If we sit around and do nothing, kids are gonna get hurt, including us.
Where did this idea come from?
I originally read the script, and the guys that wrote it are the guys that write all of the Peanuts franchise, so the Peanuts movies and the TV shows. And they said, we needed a break from writing these cartoons, and so we wanted to write this really fun monster, mysterious, spooky family movie. Mm-hmm. So they would write this like when they needed a mental break. And I had mutual friends with them, and they slipped me the script, and it was exactly the kind of thing that I was looking for. Because it took me back to my childhood where I'd watch movies with my dad. Yeah. I was like,
And it's a spooky family adventure, but it is spooky.
Yes. Yeah. And that was the thing. Like, back in the day, too, I think before PG and PG-13 distinctions, they believed kids can handle it. And they weren't dumbing things down for younger people. They believed, okay, kids are programmed with minds that can grasp good and evil, and they can see through things. I'm not going to treat a kid like a baby. We need to help them learn about the world and experience truth and vice and virtue and stories. And that's why you have all these great old fairy tales that have some scary elements in it, but purposefully to help children learn greater realities about the world. So that ethos is very much in this film.
David, you got your start as a child actor. And we're going to talk a little bit later about Wizards, which you are reviving and bringing magically
back,
taking up the wand.
Yes.
What did being a child actor, how did that inform you as a director now, interacting with younger actors?
That's a great question. And to me, it was everything on this film. It was the reason I felt like I was uniquely qualified to direct this film, because it's a lot of kids.
Yeah.
And growing up as a child actor, I experienced the good, bad, and the ugly. And I wanted to bring all of my best experiences to the table for this film to help get the performances out of those kids.
Kids are hard to deal with, though, admit it.
Yeah,
they're
100%.
Very tough. I mean, they're hard in life, I can tell you as a father of three. But, and you can, too.
As a father of three, I agree.
They're hard to deal with. On a movie set, with time ticking and pressure on, it's got to be a nightmare.
It's hard enough to get my kids to all sit and have lunch, let alone say lines and be great actors. Right. It's a really difficult task. But these kids were so gifted, so talented. They brought their A game. And I think at the core of it, too, you have to treat them like kids. The second you start treating them as something that they're not, they get uncomfortable. So there needs to be an ease or a faith when you're making the film with the kid to make them feel like your head's not going to get lopped off if you don't do this right.
Yeah.
So that's a fine line you're always walking to make sure that the kid feels like they can give a good performance and just not be crushed.
What was the bit of advice you gave them? Is there any one bit of advice or something you learned the hard way that you imparted to them?
Well, you know, I got to credit Mr. Gibson, because he taught Mason how to breathe.
Yeah.
And he talked to me about breathing and how breathing is so key to a good performance. It's one of the ways you know someone's alive,
right,
too, by the way. That's a very important thing in life.
Yeah, kind of elemental.
And if you just breathe as your character would in that moment, you're already selling half the scene. Because if your character's in a hurry and you're breathing, that's just going to sell. You don't even need to act. You're just going to look frantic.
Yeah.
And I remember Mel gave me a couple tips on breathing based on his studies. And I took Mason out to the beach. And we both stood with our feet in the water on the beach, and we did these breathing exercises and these vocal exercises that really, I think, helped him find his voice where it was and how to channel it in this character. He's already such a wonderfully talented kid that if you give him a couple tools, he knocks it out of the park.
Why did you want to do a spooky family movie now? And what was the most difficult part of this? Because you're right, we aren't doing this anymore. And this movie does have a... it feels like we've been in this place before somehow.
Yes.
It has a nostalgic feel.
Yes. And I wanted that for the parents, too, so the parents have something that invites them into the movie that they can relate to and they can gravitate towards, and the kids have a whole new experience through the kids' eyes in the film. I love the spooky element because I think it can create what we want for theaters these days, which is an event, something that can take them away from their phones and get them into a movie theater to have a communal experience. That's the power of a movie theater, is it can bring everyone together, get off your phones, and have an experience with other human beings. So to me, the spooky element, I think, really helped drive our Halloween release and make it an event-style movie. And to me, fear is one of the most fundamental characteristics kids are dealing with. And movies about overcoming your fears and challenging your fears can be one of the most powerful ways to help shape a young mind to be courageous. So to me, empty fears are bad, or not answering the fear with the proper end, not learning how to overcome that, that's bad. That's just scares with no real value to it. But this is with a purpose. It leads to a greater place.
Good. Well, speaking of overcoming your fears...
Hi!
Oh, no! No.
This is so unexpected.
Norman, I'm so glad you came.
Thank you.
No!
Don't cut yourself.
Don't right. Put that down.
Come with a sheep.
You never let him have a sword, a broadsword, or an axe, or anything like that.
Or even a guy's sword.
That's right. You play the retired cop in this movie that helps these kids.
Absolutely, yeah.
What was it like working with a bunch of young... I mean, these are very young actors.
Oh, yeah. It's great. I mean, I love working with kids because they're kind of like... they're unaffected, and they're open to all kinds of technique, and you know, you can impart stuff to them, or, you know, it's nice.
Yeah.
And working with them, you can get the timing on, and they're very malleable.
Yeah, they play along.
And they have they're there because they're naturally talented to begin with. They lack a little form,
Yeah.
But that comes with time. But they're young.
Why did you want to cast Mel in this particular role?
He was the first person that I thought of when I read it. I mean, it just it screamed him when I read it. And I also was a big fan of A Man Without a Face, and I sensed a lot of that dynamic with our two characters in this film too. And it's been a minute since that one, so I thought it'd be good timing.
And I had only recently resolved to only work with people with two first names.
So David Henry calls.
David Henry.
He fit the bill.
Yeah. Was fair and his dad's the same. His dad.
James.
Jim Henry.
Jim Henry. His brother Lorenzo Henry. I mean.
Yeah. Well, when the last name's Henry, it's kind of hard not to have two first names.
Patrick Henry. He didn't end up so well. He ended up swinging. So but this is that kind of movie. There's a little horror involved.
And fun. I mean, it's a family film, which are not really being made right now very much.
No.
For this, certainly not for the big screen. You see this stuff on streaming. You don't see it at all on the big screen.
No. I loved it. When we first met, I remember we sat down for coffee and you were like, it's Goonies with teeth. But that's perfect. That's exactly what I'm going for.
Yeah.
Goonies with teeth.
And was it?
Yeah, kind of.
It's
got a little bite in it. There's a couple of scary things.
Now, what I love is both of you are working on kind of, you're about to take up the wand again and bring the Wizards of Waverly Place back. You're about to take up the cross and bring Jesus back. Yeah. I mean, this is pretty, I mean, in some ways, these are your masterworks in some ways, things that have certainly affected and shaped your career in major ways. Yeah. Tell me about that, what that is like. First of all, bringing back something like the Wizards. I mean, it's been a long time since you waved the wand.
Yes. No, I mean, again, it goes right back into, I think, wanting to bring wholesome, worry-free family content back to families. For me, that drives me. And just great experiences that you can get powerful. You can experience a powerful story. So for me, it's along that MO.
And for you, going back to the resurrection, I know you're kind of starting pre-production.
Yeah, well, it's all based on an R-rated book called The Bible.
Oh.
and I think, but I think it's good for the whole family at some point.
Yeah, you know. Sooner or later.
Yeah.
What do you want people to take away from this film? I'll start with Mel. When you first read this script, surely you saw something there that families could sink their teeth into and that kids could enjoy.
Yeah. Hopefully. It's a little mystery involved.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few laughs. It's an adventure.
Yeah.
And I think I showed it to my son, a rough cut, and he liked it, you know. So it's, you know, it did the trick.
Yeah.
It's entertaining. It's kind of scary, you know.
And it's intriguing to kids. Kids like to be
scared.
And I
do have to say, his son is wise beyond his years.
Oh, yeah.
Years.
I agree.
Well, he's already at Stanford. He's only 7.
Amazing.
Yeah. Teaching. He's teaching.
He's teaching at MIT.
There you go.
And he's also doing a parenting show over on TLC on the weekends.
Yeah.
He's got
his own pod.
Yeah, that's his side hustle.
Right.
Why did you want families to see this now?
It goes back to my childhood. I wanted to recreate that experience I had with my father in a movie theater where you get a movie that's high quality, that has something to say, and that can be an experience for us both. Mm.
David said earlier you gave the young actor Mason in the movie some breathing tips about just breathing,
mm-hmm.
which is something
universal message.
A lot of actors lose sight of.
Not good ones.
Yeah.
But I think it's absolutely necessary to at least understand the basis of inspiration and expiration,
mm-hmm.
and what it does emotionally, and it's your base, really. It's
mm-hmm.
It's your soul.
Yeah.
It's your heart. It's everything. Breathing.
Great advice. Great sitting with both of you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Raymond.
Keep the knife to yourself.
Okay. I'll be knifed. I promise I'll be knifed.
Oh, you'll be knifed. I'll be knifed. No. Don't let him do it.
No, we got to do the music.
Oh, no. Oh, God help us. Monster Summer, directed by David Henry and starring Mel Gibson and Lorraine Bracco, opens in theaters Friday, October 4th. Visit monstersummermovie.com for tickets and showtimes in your area. He is Auxiliary Bishop of Astana, Kazakhstan, a well-known defender of the Catholic traditional faith. He joins me this evening to share his thoughts on the agenda of the second installment of the Synod on Synodality and some controversial new consultors appointed to the Vatican's doctrinal office, and his latest book, Flee from Heresy, A Catholic Guide to Ancient and Modern Errors. Please welcome back to the program Bishop Athanasius Schneider. Your Excellency, thank you for being here. Tell me why you decided it was necessary to write a book about heresies. First of all, tell us, what is a heresy, and why revive and remind us of the concept now?
Well, we are living in a time of unprecedented doctrinal crisis and confusion in the life of the Church. And so it is a requirement of my episcopal duty to help the faithful, to strengthen them in faith, and to help them to be protected of the spiritual poison of heresy, because heresy is a distortion of the divine truth which God revealed us in several forms. The heresy, formally defined, it is a denial, an obstinate denial of a divinely revealed truth. This is the official definition of heresy. And so, and there are other forms of material heresy, when there is not a formal statement, but people are speaking errors, maybe without being conscious of this. And then are simple errors of doctrine, which are not directly contradicting a dogma of faith.
Bishop, I love in the book, you quote Origen, who says that, heresy is really like lights on cliffs to allure and destroy vessels in quest of refuge, so that the prince of the world lights fires of false knowledge in order to destroy men. I thought that was an apt visual of what a heresy is. You have assembled here a compendium of heresies: Gnosticism and pantheism, Arianism, Wycliffeism, rejecting, the papal primacy, Freemasonry. Why is it necessary to remind faithful people of these errors from the past and the present?
Well, to say that there were always heresies in the life of the Church and will be, because the Church is a militant Church, and we have to fight for the truth, we have to fight for Christ, we have to fight for saved souls from the darkness of error. And so the heresies, as Origen mentioned, they have this seductive power to seduce people by apparent truth or half truth. And therefore, they are so dangerous. And the task of the Church since the apostolic times is to unmask these fake doctrines, these attempts to deceive the simple faithful.
Your Excellency, what is the gravest modern error or heresy that you encounter in your work today?
I would consider the greatest modern heresy and error, it is relativism, doctrinal relativism, that says that there is no permanent, perennial truth. That truth is, they say, changing according to the historical times and circumstances. Basically, relativism says that truths is a product of man. So man says what is true and what is not true. It is a complete subjectivism, and so man, he becomes the lord of truth or not truth. And this is a direct attack against the divine primacy of God, who is the truth, Jesus Christ, and who reveals us the truth.
relative to all of this, Your Excellency, there are a number of new consultors who were appointed this week at the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith. That is the Vatican's doctrinal office, 28 of them, to be exact. Now, most of these consultors are Italian priests and theologians. There are a few nuns. But I want to highlight two of these consultors. First, to Father Maurizio Chiodi. He is a moral theologian who, in 2022, said Catholics could, in some cases, disregard church teaching on contraception. And then, citing Amoris Laetitia, he said, under certain conditions and deepening of circumstances, homosexual relationships can be the most fruitful way for homosexual couples to enjoy good relations, end quote. Your Excellency, what do you make of this appointment to the Vatican's doctrinal office?
Well, first, as a bishop, I cannot criticize the papal appointments. This is a task of the Pope. But I can only speak, and I don't know exactly these theologians all. But what I want to say is something in principle. So the Dicastery for the Doctrine of Faith is an advisory body for the Pope, for the Roman Pontiff, for his most important task to keep and transmit the Catholic faith, the deposit of faith, inviolable, and so and integrally. And this dicastery and the consultors, they have the task to help the Pope to transmit, to keep the faith integrally, inviolably. And therefore, they must be the best and most surest theologians who are examples of fidelity to the Catholic faith. And this requires the nature of the meaning of the Dicastery for the Doctrine of Faith, as well as the nature of the papal office, to be the teacher of the entire church. The Roman Church is the mother and teacher of all churches since the beginning. And so the Pope must, with the help of the Dicastery, fulfill his first task to strengthen the faithful in faith, as our Lord said to St. Peter. And so, and not to confuse the faithful. And when there are theologians, as you mentioned, who obviously contradict the perennial teaching of the Church with some trickery rhetorics, which is Gnostic method and heretic method, they are for sure not a help for the Pope, but the contrary. And so we must pray that the Pope may choose very true, faithfully theologians for his advisors.
Yeah, Your Excellency, another moral theologian also appointed to the Dicastery of the Doctrine of Faith, Pier Davide Guenzi. He also has been appointed, and he says, in light of Amoris Laetitia, gay couples must be reconsidered, and, quote, we have learned that the natural law must be continually rethought, end quote. Bishop, your reaction, and how does Amoris Laetitia have such moral and doctrinal power that it authorizes the reinvestigation, indeed the rethinking, of natural law?
I would say this is the tragedy of this document, Amoris Laetitia, with this very ambiguous language, which opens the door for erroneous interpretations, erroneous application for the moral life. It is simply a tool, becomes a tool for undermining the clear divine commandments. The Pope, the magisterium is not above the divine commandments. He is not above the word of God written and transmitted in tradition. But as the Second Vatican Council says in the document Dei Verbum, that the magisterium, in first place the Pope, is the servant. He is subject to the word of God. He has to serve it, not to be the master or to change it, even with rhetorics or with some alleged pastoral methods. They must correspond to the clear divine teaching.
As you know, Your Excellency, Pope Francis made comments at an interreligious meeting last week that are still being felt. I'm still getting questions about this. He said, quote, "Every religion is a way to arrive at God. There are different languages to arrive at God, but God is for all. There is only one God, and each of us has a language to arrive at God. Sikh, Muslim, Hindu, Christian, they are different paths." Your Excellency, is every religion a path to God? And does that square with traditional Catholic teaching about Christ and the unique place his salvific power has in the world?
Such affirmation of Pope Francis, which you quoted, is clearly against the divine revelation. It contradicts directly the first commandment of God, which is ever valid: you shall not have other gods besides me. This is so clear. And such statement contradicts the entire gospel, where Jesus Christ said, no one comes to the Father except through me. He is the only way to God. There are no other ways or path. So in this statement, sadly, regrettably, Pope Francis plainly contradicts the first commandment of God and the entire gospel.
That's a difficult thing to process, I think, for a lot of Catholics, Bishop, that, the Pope is saying something that runs counter to the first commandment of God. How do you reconcile that? How do you reconcile that as a bishop? How do you reconcile that as a faithful Catholic?
Well, we had, God permitted that the first pope, Simon Peter, he renounced, denied Christ, we know, three times.
Mm-hmm.
And he was appointed the vicar of Christ, and nevertheless, he denied Christ three times. So God permitted it, that it could also happen in the future, that a successor of Simon Peter would speak some words, some affirmations, which are contrary to the divine truth. It is rarely, but it happened with Peter, and it happened in very rare cases in the history. But Peter repented, and he again defended Christ and confessed him and gave his life for Christ as a martyr. And so in this case today, we have to simply to pray for Pope Francis that he may receive this grace of the Lord as Peter received, to repent and to again clearly, courageously confess that there is no other name given to man in which they can be saved except Jesus Christ, the incarnate Son of God, the only Redeemer of mankind.
Bishop, I want to get your take on the upcoming Synod on Synodality. It's about to begin in October. Before the Synod begins, participants will gather in retreat, and they'll hold a penitential celebration led by Pope Francis. Now, according to the Secretary General of the Synod, in this communal confession of sorts, Participants will confess sins in the name of the baptized. Those sins include, and I quote, sin against creation, against indigenous populations, against migrants, sin of using doctrine as stones to be hurled, sin against synodality, a lack of listening, communion, and participation of all. Bishop Schneider, does questioning the validity of, say, holy orders of women, a settled matter until recently, or attacks on marriage, does that constitute grave sin in your mind?
Well, the so-called sin against synodality is an invented sin. We have no such sins in the divine revelation. It is a tool to promote a new agenda in the synod to establish new doctrines which are contrary to the divine revelation or undermine divine revelation. And such new established, invented doctrines in this so-called synodality, these are the true stones which they throw to the faithful, because they are distortions, and these are hurting, harming the faithful and putting in danger the eternal salvation. And a true doctrine, it's not against charity. To transmit doctrine is one of the highest expression of charity towards the neighbor, to bring them the light of truth. And the light of truth only gives us true happiness. And such confused new synodal doctrines and methods, they bring us ambiguity, uncertainty. And this, no one will give his life for something which is ambiguous, which is uncertain. Mm. We will only give our life for what is true, what is solid as a rock, which is Christ. He is the rock. He is the truth. And only for him, with God's grace, every Christian must be ready to give his life.
Your Excellency, I thought communal confession and absolution were only to be given in extreme emergencies, like in times of war. Your thoughts on creating this public penitential service to forgive these alleged sins at the start of a synod?
Well, I don't know if this will be a sacramental general absolution in Rome. I don't know. If it should not be, because a so-called general sacramental absolution, according to the church norms, are only possible in extreme situations of emergency, of danger of life. And there is no danger of life and emergency in Rome. There are plenty priests so that people can do an individual confession of their sins according to the doctrine and praxis of the church.
Bishop Schneider, as we've been reporting over many, many weeks, the most controversial issues from last year's synod, women's ordination, LGBT issues, those have now all been removed from discussion and shifted to study groups. My question is, does it concern you that those issues will not be discussed in public, but only within these groups that are being hand-selected until June of next year?
Well, I think this concerns me because the truth must be spoken, discussed openly and in a transparency. Nothing is hidden which will not be revealed. And such methods can be also dangerous, then will appear a document suddenly, as we had last year with the so-called fiducia supplicans document. Suddenly appeared a document which introduced such an abomination of giving blessings to homosexual, evidently homosexual unions, which contradicts natural law, contradicts divine law. And I hope that such commissions will not produce such a sudden document for female ordinations or other issues which will plainly contradict divine revelation or undermine it. So, therefore, I think we must pray very fervently, all the true sons and daughters of the Church, that God may intervene in His Holy Church, in the Holy See, and again give us shepherds in Rome, all over the world, where true apostolic man, true Catholic, to serve the Lord and not the time.
Your Excellency, tell me how your book, Flee from Heresy, and the historical analysis it provides into these heresies, how do they help us today dealing with all that we're seeing and to put into context what we're seeing? What's the lesson for the faithful here?
Yes, we are today witnessing the height of the so-called modernism, which is, according to the definition of Pope Pius X, a synthesis of all heresies which existed. And so it is, because it is completely relativistic. And therefore, it is necessary and helpful for the faithful to know that there were already so many heresies, and to identify them. And so when they are today observing such confusion, they may say, oh, these were already in some way present in the past time. And we have to be aware and know well our faith. So when you are concerned with the bodily health, you must know the dangers for your health, the viruses and so on. And so the heresies and errors are kind of spiritual poisons and viruses which we must know to protect ourselves, to protect our children, the youth, and all the people of goodwill who sincerely seek the truth. This is the spiritual health. And therefore, to warn people of heresy, to say them flee from heresy, is one of the greatest acts of true charity.
Yeah, Bishop, reading your book, it reminds me there's nothing new under the sun, including heresies. They continue to repeat themselves through time. They just take on different guises, slightly different masks. But on the whole, it's the same through line. It's the same virus, as you said. Flee from Heresy, A Catholic Guide to Ancient and Modern Errors, by Bishop Athanasius Schneider, is available now at bookstores everywhere and online, and of course through the EWTN catalog. Bishop Schneider, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
The Senate's bipartisan report on the failures of the U.S. Secret Service protecting former President Trump is causing quite a stir in Washington this week, and for the first time in recent memory, a presidential candidate is skipping the Al Smith Catholic Charity Dinner in New York City. Joining me now with analysis of this and much more, senior political editor and Washington correspondent at The Blaze News, Chris Bedford. Chris, thanks for being here. I want to begin with this blockbuster bipartisan congressional report on the performance of the Secret Service in the wake of not one but two assassination attempts on former President Trump. Democrat Senator Richard Blumenthal had this to say about the report. What happened on July 13th was an accumulation of errors that produced a perfect storm of stunning failure. It was a tragedy and completely preventable from the outset. There was both a failure to provide resources like a working radio, drone detection system, and counter-surveillance team, and lack of an effective chain of command. Looking forward, we need structural reform in the agency itself. Chris, your thoughts on these findings of this bipartisan report? Blumenthal, certainly no fan of Donald Trump. Is Congress finally treating this as a threat to the entire country rather than just a targeted political exercise at one party or the other?
Yes, I think Senator Blumenthal has been rather impressive on this. And I've been surprised at how vocal, just how incredibly vocal he has been. He hasn't tried to make this about gun control or anything else. He's been talking explicitly about the Secret Service. And we really started to get this idea during Barack Obama's presidency. I mean, I remember when I was a kid and I first came to D.C., walking by the White House, I just assumed that there were snipers everywhere and the whole place was completely guarded. And then under Barack Obama, we learned that you could actually land a homemade helicopter in the White House lawn. Or maybe you could get through the front door if you're real sneaky about it. That the Secret Service had a lot of reputation, but the protocols, the training, the hiring process, the checks and balances had really broken down. And the number of these which broke down the day that Donald Trump was almost assassinated, a day that Blumenthal and other Democrats know was not good for their party, was not good for the country, was not good for anyone. They look at the mistakes here and they're saying, what was going on? The lack of communication. Why did one special agent in charge, or one special agent who was supposedly in charge, know that there was a credible threat on the ground, but not communicate that to the agents who were actually there? Breakdowns like that are inexcusable. The only reason that Donald Trump wasn't killed is because of the wind and an act of God. It had nothing to do with the Secret Service succeeding.
Yeah, Chris, look, the report shows the gravity and the magnitude of the failure here by the Secret Service. But the president and vice president, Biden and Harris, have yet to call out the agency for the security breakdown, not only in Butler, but later in Florida. Why not, given their positions and their vulnerabilities? Your thoughts on this?
I think they don't care. I really don't think that this is I think they don't. They obviously don't want to see it happen, but it's not something that's going to move the needle on getting Harris and the Biden administration essentially reelected. They don't want to criticize it. They don't want to give any more airtime. If you watch that shameful, probably only debate we're going to have, the moderators never even brought it up. Donald Trump had to actually bring it up. They're trying to memory hole it, but it's not really working. I mean, if you walk into I was just on summer vacation a few weeks ago. All of the T-shirt shops that sell pop culture and rock shirts were selling Trump T-shirts with the assassination picture on it. It's entered pop culture. It's out of their control.
Yeah. Donald Trump was briefed this week by U.S. intelligence on alleged assassination threats coming from Iran, according to his campaign. Now, the Republican candidate was informed of, quote, real and specific threats aimed at destabilizing the United States. Here's what the former president had to say from North Carolina this week.
But if I were the president, I would inform the threatening country, in this case Iran, that if you do anything to harm this person, we are going to blow your largest cities and the country itself to smithereens. We're going to blow it to smithereens. You can't do that. And there would be no more threats. There would be no more threats. But right now, we don't have that leadership or the necessary people, the necessary leaders.
Do you entirely buy this Iran explanation, though? I mean, these two would-be assassins were radicalized political opponents of the president.
Well, yeah, they had nothing to do with Iran, as far as I can tell. There's been no evidence put forward of that. The CIA likes to, and the intelligence services certainly like to whisper about foreign plots every time there's an inconvenient story for them. But Iran definitely does have kill teams. People like Mike Pompeo have to live with 24/7 security because they've got a death mark. That's what happens when you kill Iran's top assassins. But Donald Trump prove this. I mean, people in D.C. like to pretend that things are extremely complicated and can't be fixed. We can't slow down or even stop illegal immigration. We can't cause these rogue nations to behave. Well, Donald Trump, just in 4 years, even with an administration that wasn't always functioning at the highest level and had a lot of people pushing back against it, was able to do that in the southern border and was able to get countries like Iran, leave them poor or leave them weaker, knock off their top people with impunity, because he walked loudly, but he carried a big stick and was willing to use it.
Shifting to the presidential campaign, Democratic presidential nominee Vice President Kamala Harris announced she's skipping this year's Al Smith dinner in New York City. Instead, she'll be focused on campaigning in New York. Now, look, as most of our viewers know, and I know as you know, Chris, the Al Smith dinner is this big archdiocesan charitable fundraiser. And it's always been kind of a bipartisan, good-natured affair that traditionally hosts both presidential candidates. Donald Trump announced he will be attending. Cardinal Timothy Dolan, Archbishop of New York, had this to say.
We were looking forward to giving the vice president an enthusiastic welcome. She speaks very much about the high ideals and how it's good to get away from division and come together in unity and all. We're not used to this. We don't know how to handle it. This hasn't happened in 40 years since Walter Mondale turned down the invitation. And remember, he lost 49 out of 50 states. Now, I don't want to say there's a direct connection there.
Chris, Dolan later chalked it up to Harris getting bad advice. What do you make of the vice president's decision to forego this dinner?
Well, she probably did get some bad advice, but she's also got it coming from herself. She is the most openly anti-Catholic candidate for any major party for president in decades and decades and decades. She's someone who says the Knights of Columbus are an extremist organization, the kind of thing that could bar someone from being able to be a judge. She's not just a vociferous defender of abortion, but she publicly goes after those groups that go out and try to help single mothers and struggling mothers to care for their children and provide millions of dollars in medical support and diapers and all the incredibly expensive things that you need. She lights up when she talks about abortion. She considers Catholics to be radical. So they probably looked at this dinner. A lot of her staff completely lack American history and the basics of that. Don't realize that it's a good-natured bipartisan affair that always yields some couple of good headlines, some jokes. People can be a little lighthearted while raising money for a good cause. And also, like Walter Mondale, she's possibly losing this election. She needs to be out there campaigning. Yeah.
Well, she's down 5 points in the Pew, poll with Catholics. We'll see how far she actually is. But if that's a bellwether for the direction of this campaign, could be bad for her. But look, Chris, how can she stand there? You saw that Stephanie Ruhle interview this week on MSNBC. Now, that was a friendly, cushy, but they were practically spooning in the middle of that interview. And still, Kamala Harris was flat-footed, couldn't really find a through line. She was lost at many moments. You can only imagine her there on the stage in a gown when Donald Trump is calling her out for being anti-Catholic. I don't think she knows how she would respond, and they worry about that image, right?
That's why they have to hide her. She is uniquely bad at this. That's why she was not just the last choice of Democratic voters in the primary, but she was the last choice for Democratic Party poobahs when they were trying to figure out what to do about replacing Joe Biden. Mm. She's not up to this job. Every time she talks, she sounds like someone giving a book report on a book she didn't read and trying to reach a minimum word count that she can't even possibly get to by just filling it in with word salad. And it shows when she's in public.
Yeah, or maybe her staff wants to avoid a moment like this. This is the vice president earlier this week. Listen, Chris.
There's a time for patience, and there's a time for impatience. That's not in Ecclesiastics.
Or Ecclesiastes. Chris, Harris seems to be losing altitude in the swing states and overall in the latest polls. She's even down among Notre Dame kids. You saw that poll of kids from Notre Dame. They haven't supported a Republican in over a decade. Why is Harris flagging after that big boomlet we saw?
Ecclesiastics sounds like a good cardio workout to me. And I bet if you pulled church-attending Catholics, her numbers would be even lower. I feel like not enough Catholic leaders have really broadcast just how anti-Catholic she is. The Catholic vote itself as a voting bloc hasn't really held together since the bishops, I think, spent it unwisely on John F. Kennedy because he was Catholic, even though he didn't back any Catholic positions at all. Since then, it started to splinter and lean Democratic, largely because Catholics are from the North and places like that, where there is a lot more Republican voting than down in the South. So once you're actually starting to lose Catholics and the cultural Catholics and those who say they check the box in the poll but maybe don't go to Mass except on Christmas and Easter, then you're really in trouble as a candidate. It shows how broad her unpopularity is.
Before we run out of time, President Biden showed up this week. He addressed the UN, pledging even more support to Ukraine.
We're launching a joint declaration of support for Ukraine, recovery and reconstruction to make it clear we stand with Ukraine now and in the future. That starts on the battlefield. I'm determined to ensure that Ukraine has what it needs to prevail in its fight for survival.
Chris, your thoughts on this endless well of support by the Biden administration, billions of dollars to Ukraine, even furnishing them now. There are calls to give them missiles that can reach the interior of Russia.
Yeah, and those are the missiles that Zelensky is really campaigning to get. Those are the missiles he thinks he can use to negotiate really hard and force a treaty on Putin. But it's also a massive escalation. And Putin, who's actually been a little measured in his saber rattling towards the West, has said this will be a cause for escalation and potential war with NATO. Something that really is, you really do want to avoid. Can you imagine the French and the German military in the front lines? They have not been fighting very many wars in the past few decades and are completely unprepared for this sort of escalation. Mm. At the same time, you have Senate Republicans out there, Mitch McConnell walking through the Senate halls with Zelensky, even while Zelensky's campaigning against Donald Trump. They're showing, and they're going to try and do this in the omnibus, that no matter who is elected in this coming election, the money will keep on flowing. The Senate will make sure that billions and more dollars of American taxpayers go to the continuing this war with no end in sight. I mean, if Lindsey Graham has his way, there will be 10 years of U.S. taxpayer support guaranteed for Ukraine, and no president will be in charge of our foreign policy.
It's amazing. Both parties. You always find a plurality in both parties, Chris, who will support unending wars no matter where they are. It's astounding. It's the only bipartisan issue you can really find in D.C. Another story that seems to get little attention from this administration is illegal immigration and criminal illegal aliens. In a multi-day operation, ICE's Boston office this week rounded up four illegal aliens charged with rape, sexual assault of children, and upon the residents in Nantucket, who were all previously released by law enforcement despite the charges. The four, two Salvadorans, a Brazilian, and a Guatemalan, were all gotaways. Massachusetts is, of course, a sanctuary state. Your thoughts on this latest news and how it reflects on Harris's trip to the border, which she's making any day now.
Well, it shows you that there is no border. This is in Nantucket, which I grew up in Massachusetts. Nantucket is not easy to get to. And it also shows that, unfortunately, it's really particularly tragic because I still don't think this is going to be affecting the rich people of that island. Even though it's a very small island, where if you go to a bar in Nantucket, it's strange. You'll see the postman hanging out with a billionaire, and they know each other. In general, a lot of the wealthy people are sequestered on their estates or at the clubs. They have their own land. And a lot of the people who work that island, who are in the service industries, the people who are crowded into apartments because it's very expensive so they can work a job that summer— I guarantee you these are some of the people whose children are falling prey to this kind of animal behavior.
The CBP data shows that there were nearly 2 million gotaways who have evaded capture and snuck back into the United States during the Biden administration. I mean, it's a staggering statistic. These are just four that happen to be criminals, criminal elements. But God knows how many others are in those 2 million, that 2 million count. Chris, we've got 39 days until the election on November 5th. What do you think we'll see on Election Day? Any predictions at this point? What are you seeing in the trends in the polls?
Well, the trends in the polls are moving in the right direction for Republicans and the wrong correct direction for Democrats. I can only assume that the Democrats' internal polling is pretty bad, considering how they're still pushing for a debate. They're still talking about that. They're putting Kamala Harris out there more and more. They put Joe Biden on The View. This is a sign that they're starting to try and shift their strategy because they're looking at those numbers. They're knowing that Donald Trump is always undercounted. They're looking at how he's down by little or up by a couple points in state after state. Listen, it's still a toss-up. People still need to come out and vote. But this election has got Democrats worried, and I think rightly.
We will leave it there. Read Chris Bedford's commentary. You can find it at The Blaze News at theblaze.com/Bedford. Follow him on X at C. Bedford, D.C. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Raymond.
That is all the time we have for now. Next week, my complete interview with comedian and author Rob Schneider. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.